It was December 1st, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, when a 42-year-old African-American woman refused to move. The bus driver said, "Give up your seat. This white man needs to sit." And she said, "No." "I was tired," Rosa Parks explained later. "I just wanted to sit down." Last week, I told you how bravery is motivated by a sense of duty and reverence. But sometimes resistance comes from a more basic kind of surrender. I'm done moving. I'm done giving in. And still, her response seems to me an insufficient explanation for the moment. And it obscures what actually makes such moments possible. Our culture relishes in stories of individualized bravery, these singular moments. But in reality, these moments are always built on foundations of smaller moments, where we try and fail and learn and stick with it. Many of us, over many years, sticking with it, not because we know for sure that justice will come, but because it's right and we can do no other. As Parks also said, "When I made that decision, I knew I had the strength of my ancestors with me. I knew I was not alone." Parks' refusal to move was, in fact, a part of the African American community's plan of resistance that they've been rolling out for some time, using the infrastructure of the NAACP to provide that sense of solidarity and the opportunity to practice so that when the time came, they'd be ready. Her act of resistance and the boycott it inspired was, as poet Seamus Heaney wrote, a longed-for tidal wave of justice, a moment when hope and history rhyme. But it was not, as Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams might say, a moment of immaculate conception. It did not spring forth all on its own. I mean, we don't believe in the immaculate conception of anything. I've been thinking a lot of Rosa Parks lately and how big moments happen because of a lot of little moments, particularly in the context of last Sunday, which was great fun. It was incredible to experience your enthusiastic support for calling a second minister for the first time in this church's history. That was what the claps were about earlier for all you guests that are with us this morning. It was a great moment that all of you made possible. Of course, the vote does not constitute the extent of what's exciting in our church right now. I took a call this week from someone who went on and on about how Mark's sermon the week before had connected to a deep longing she had always felt. How's that for 40 years in? And then days like today remind us just how huge our choir is, and I mean its size, but even more, its power. Its capacity to transport, strengthen, and inspire us. And 250 children, that's our kids, are a part of our religious education community, our religious education program, through which we give them the gift of community and the promise of our liberal faith. And I do mean we. Over 60 of you volunteer to teach our children what it means that we are all worthy and all of us belong. By year's end, about 200 of you will have experienced greater connections through small group ministry. And even in the midst of what has been some terrible weather, our end of life series has seen a big turnout, underscoring just how important our adult enrichment ministry is. 140 of you have brought meals and stayed overnight in this past church year, helping us to host homeless families. We've donated 22,307 pounds of food to the food bank, and 42 of you show up every week to tutor 60 individuals in English as a second language. We've taken 14 carloads of stuff of all kinds and $2,000 to our companion family in Greeley, whose lives were turned upside down by the flooding. These are just a few of the exciting things that our community is up to. I'm sure you all could name many, many more. It is an exciting moment to be a part of this church. And as with that great civil rights moment in 1955, all this goodness rests upon a long history. This moment did not make itself. Just over 117 years ago, a small group came together to see about forming a liberal church in Fort Collins. Records show their first meeting was on December 26, 1897, which I like to imagine came in response to their mutual frustration at not being able to find a Christmas service that satisfied their shared liberal longings. Even before that, the Reverend Anna Jane Norris had been stirring things up, trying to get a liberal church started. You heard right. Anna Jane, we female liberal ministers go all the way back to the 1890s in northern Colorado. What did Anna Jane Norris and that resulting group of Unitarians and Universalists imagine in those early days? Did they imagine us? Did they know the shade they were casting so that our way would be easier through this desert that life can so often be? When the vote was counted and I was standing here with my daughter and you all were clapping and we were filled with joy, I said, thank you. By which I meant thank you to all of you, this group in particular, but also thank you to all those many people who walked all those steps to get us here. To Anna Jane Norris and that gathering in 1897, to all those church members and leaders between then and now, thank you to the women's group of 1917, the predecessors to today's slightly senior sisterhood. They completely wiped out all the church's debt in one single year through their own giving and their determined fundraising. Thank you to what our church historian, Art Corey, calls a small group of stubborn Unitarians, to which I say, are there any other kinds, who in 1968 remained after the building was sold and the minister had left. Thank you to that group for sticking with it. Thank you to the search committee of 1971 for holding out until they found the right minister in the Reverend Walter Royal Jones, Jr. And thank you, Roy, for putting into this church's living memory what it meant to have a long-term ministry. Because surely that set the stage for Mark's ministry. And where would we be today without Mark? Every good thing we experience today has its roots in some similar beginning. People start to talk. Things get stirred up, the stirring becomes commitment, and the commitment becomes meetings, lots of meetings. People give their time and their money, and somehow, little by little, these ideas and dreams, they become reality. And so I say thank you. Because while I am excited about our future, my excitement is built on the awareness and gratitude for all that has come before. I just got to show up and receive. Didn't we all? Didn't we all receive everything as a gift? We did not make ourselves. This Sunday marks the beginning of our annual pledge drive, and before you put up your resistance to a talk about money, I invite you to think again about that story of the desert and the trees, and I invite you to think again about all those who paved the way for us, who dreamed and worked and gave so that this very moment could happen. And then imagine what all that asks of us. I spent some time in Everyday Joe's yesterday. I love that place. And you probably know it's a project of the Timberline Church. And every time I go there and I talk to their volunteer staff, volunteer baristas, I think, why don't we have a coffee shop? Or when I'm driving by CSU, I think, why aren't we on the campus? I mean, do we not believe our message of love and belonging and acceptance is just as worthy? Do we not believe that we could matter that much? Friends, let's get over that. Let's let go of the idea that we should skimp by. Let's grow big roots. Plant lots of trees. Let's give generously in response to all this beauty that we have been given. My family, Carrie and I, we have committed to giving nearly 3% of our family income to the church this year. That's a big jump for us. It more than doubles our pledge. I hope it signals to all of you our commitment and our gratitude for all this goodness we just get to receive. And I hope it inspires you to join us, to give generously, whatever that can mean for you. This very moment, we are held by the strength of our ancestors. Their vision beckons us, summons us to our boldest dreams and brightest possibilities. We have come so far, and yet we're just getting started. As we celebrate our roots, may we reach for the sky. May it be so.
Thank you, Ryan, and thank you very much, choir. I'd like to remind the congregation that when I arrived here in 1991, we had no choir, we had no music director, and at one time, when we did have a choir, it was 8 people strong. Oh, well. So, my job is to look forward, not backward. And I do so with the help of Dr. Michio Kaku. He is professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York. He's the author of a forthcoming book, The Future of the Mind. In November 28 of 2013, he wrote for the New York Times, "A Scientist Predicts the Future." And he said, when making the predictions, he has 2 qualifications. The predictions cannot violate the laws of physics, and prototypes have to exist for all the things that he foresees happening. He wrote, "I've interviewed more than 300 of the world's top scientists, and many allowed me into their laboratories where they are inventing the future. Their accomplishments and dreams are eye-opening. From my conversations with them, here's a glimpse of what to expect in the coming decades." I've edited the article, so I hope these are the highlights. Computers will disappear. The brain net will augment the internet. He wrote, "In decades to come, we will control computers with our minds, not a mouse. The European Union and the United States are committing hundreds of millions of dollars to map the neural pathways of the brain. This could alleviate the misery of those suffering from mental illness and allow paralyzed people to control computers, video games, appliances, wheelchairs, and mechanical arms and legs with sheer thought. Robots will be commonplace. After false starts, artificial intelligence is slowly entering everyday life. RoboDoc and RoboLawyer, animated doctors or lawyers, will soon give instant, reliable advice any time of day in simple language." But as I assured Gretchen, I have not seen any prediction for robo-minister. "Aged body parts will be replaced. Diseased and old body parts will be replaced just as we now replace auto parts. Already from your own cells, scientists can grow skin, cartilage, noses, blood vessels, bladders, and windpipes. In the future, scientists will grow more complex organs such as livers and kidneys. The phrase organ failure will disappear." The last prediction, my own personal favorite, "Parents will design their offspring." In a few decades, parents may be able to choose many genetic characteristics of their children. Our genes will be sequenced and recorded at a cost of less than $100. Many damaged and dysfunctional genes in our genome may be cured using gene therapy, possibly leading to genetic enhancement. Already, smart mouse and mighty mouse genes have been isolated that can create mice with superior memory and strength, and these genes have human counterparts. Well, if you have any kind of imagination, let's forget about the zombie apocalypse and go for the mouse apocalypse. They're getting stronger every day. But it's all going to be okay, right? No global climate change mentioned, no dystopia. Instead, we can replace our aged body parts, choose our children from the latest prototypes, and blissfully enter into this brave new world. Cool. Even awesome. But quite possibly not what our actual future will look like. There is a study of the future. It's sometimes called future studies, futurology. And the work of this field is to look at possible, probable, and preferable futures. But there is debate as to whether the discipline is an art or a science. So those are the three P's and a W. Possible, probable, and preferable futures. The W is wild cards. Things that are not foreseen, they could be positive or negative, but whenever they appear, they have a major impact on the nature of the world. But futurists have a decidedly mixed reputation and patchy track record at successful prediction. For example, in the 1950s, futurists predicted that space tourism would be common. They ignored the possibility of ubiquitous and cheap personal computers. And imagine trying to predict the future in the year 1900. It was a time of optimism, really. Who would have foreseen the First World War and a generation of European youth wiped out? And after the First World War, who would have foreseen the rise of Hitler and the Holocaust? Closer to our time, the Arab Spring, the resurgence of Apple computer, the smartphone, the shock of 9/11, all these realities, unpredicted. Philip Tetlock, who I've talked to you about before, wrote a book called Expert Political Judgment, How Good Is It? The answer is, not so good. He wrote, in the short term, we can beat... Now, let me back up. Here's what he said. Long-term predictions have been found to be about as accurate as monkeys tossing darts at a board labeled with potential future outcomes. These poor monkeys, have you ever thought about them? We talk about them again and again. Monkeys throwing darts, monkeys in a room typing. I don't know where these monkeys are coming from, but the point is, as he says, in the short term, human beings can beat the dart-throwing chimp by pretty good margins. But as we get further out into the future, it gets increasingly difficult to predict. When Vicki, Becky, David, and I arrived in Fort Collins in 1991, this church was healthy, and Fort Collins looked like a great place to raise a family. And we could afford to buy a house. Coming from a parsonage in Boston, that was not an easy proposition. From the vantage point of 1991, I could not predict that our congregation would almost double its membership and move to a multi-staff, two-minister structure. I could not have predicted that we would change from a church with very few evening activities, except for committee meetings, to the bustling place we are today. But that seems to join the regular message that says we can't really predict the future very well. Management consultant Peter Drucker, who died in 2005, made a huge impact on management studies and the business community. This is what he once said. Trying to predict the future is like trying to drive down a country road at night with no lights while looking out the back window. That surely led to another famous quotation from Peter Drucker: "The best way to predict the future is to create it." One of the affirmations of this year's pledge drive. Future. Such an interesting concept. Ideas and plans already laid out in front of us. But a future is more than just an idea. It's every possibility, every chance for something altering to occur. Such a future comes from a biased past, one filled with truth, with lies, with alibis, crossed with emotions and actions. This past turns into now, a now riddled with uncertainty and decisions, full of memories and hopes and dreams. Who knows which path you will choose, which wine you will taste, whose heart will break? The one thing about our future is that we have to live now to ever reach then. This future is only reached by living through today, through the memories of futures past and the choices we make tomorrow. As for the future at the Foothills Unitarian Church, we only get there by living through today, through the memories of futures past and the choices you will make tomorrow. But if the past provides us with any insight, we can say that though there have been struggles and difficult times in this congregation, our little church has weathered storms, surfed the high waves, hunkered down in shelter when necessary, and kept one another as safe and protected as possible in an unpredictable world. Our congregation's MO has been to try for flexibility, purposefulness, creative problem solving, while always being receptive to amazing grace and just plain good luck. We are pragmatists, and we know that no future is guaranteed. If the future were guaranteed, what would be the point of being who we are? What would be the point of thinking or creating or striving or caring? We live the adventure of life precisely because of its uncertainty on the one hand and the possibility of our making a difference on the other. Vicki and I have faith that with generous donations of your time, your talent, and your treasure, you will sustain and enhance the ability of this church to make an important difference both inside and beyond our walls. I have to mention one more thing. The business of predicting the outcome of sporting events has become a big business. And you might imagine why, because millions and millions of dollars rest upon the outcome of our sporting competitions. Handicappers predict the outcome of games using mathematical formula, simulation models, or qualitative analysis. Predictions now typically consist of two distinct approaches: situational plays and statistical-based models. Situational plays are much more difficult to measure because they usually involve assessing the motivation of a team. Dan Gordon is a noted handicapper, and he wrote, "Without an emotional edge in a game, in addition to the value of the team, I won't put my money on it." So, go Broncos. Well, I mean that sincerely because, yes, it was pretty awful last Sunday, just 1 week ago. All those newspaper articles and predictions and the photos, it just proves the point, doesn't it, that you can't predict the future. However much you write about it, it will turn out to be surprising. But if you play a sport, however good you are, if you strike out, unless you quit the game, you're going to be up to bat another time. And if you are a player for the Broncos, well, Peyton Manning probably has another season left to play. And we don't know what that season will be like, do we? None of us can, because we don't know what our season will be like either. We do know this, that after many losses of friends and loved ones, we keep going. Otherwise, we would quit. The First World War, the Second, the Holocaust, Bosnia. There's enough at Columbine to make us consider giving up, or there was on one awful day. But we're not people who give up. We are people who create and strive and think. That's our mandate, our birthright, our calling. It's who we have to be, we need to be, and we must be. We are players, and we keep playing the game.
And amen.